The Hard Shoulder on News Talk.
With the all-new Nissan Juke. The coupe crossover by Nissan. Nissan. Innovation that excites.
Tánaiste Dé Leo Varadkar, you're very welcome to the show.
Evening. Thanks thanks for having me in.
We were speaking earlier about various issues and in the context of many discussions, vaccines have been mentioned, and vaccines are, of course, the great white hope. They are the light at the end of the tunnel for people. But it would probably be remiss of us to talk about them without acknowledging that we are in the midst of a crisis, mm-hmm. and hospitals talking about implementing emergency measures, about the need to take over more of the capacity in private hospitals, possibly entire private hospitals. Where are we, or what's your reading of the situation on the ground?
Yeah, we're in the middle of a third wave of the pandemic, and that wave is every bit as bad, if not worse, than the first wave. And the situation in our hospitals in particular is very grave, very precarious. Still deteriorating today, and really want to express my thanks and appreciation to all the healthcare workers working in our hospitals and care homes and the community. And the best way we can help them at the moment is to turn off the tap, to reduce the number of people getting infected, therefore reduce the number of people being hospitalised. And that means staying at home, at least for the next couple of weeks. And it means hands, face, space, wash your hands, cover our face when we go out, and keep 2 metres apart from people whenever possible. We know this works. It beat the virus twice. We need to now beat it again a third time. But there are glimmers of hope, and this could change. So I'd heavily caveat this. Mm. But we are seeing the positivity rate fall. Like, so in the labs today, the positivity rate was 14%. Had been 25%.
Wow,
just after New Year's. Still about 3,000 or 4,000 cases a day, still way too high, but seems it's going in the right direction. And even in the hospitals, we've won 69 people in ICU today, which is a huge number. But there were 14 admitted and 12 discharged. So, you know, a net increase of 2, whereas it had been 10 previously. And in the hospitals, 1,838 people in hospital with COVID. 149 admitted, but 128 discharged. So again, you know, what you really want is more people discharged than admitted.
Yeah.
We're not there yet, but we might get there in the next week or two. So that's a kind of a glimmer of hope, but it will get worse until then.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, because in terms of community transmission, it certainly looks like we've turned a corner, albeit slowly, and we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But it is the accepted wisdom, is it, that it will get worse before it gets better in hospitals?
Yeah, I think at least for the next week or two. But as it seems we've turned the corner in terms of case numbers, we would hope and be reasonably confident that we'll turn the corner in hospitalizations and ICU in the next week or two. The problem is we're turning the corner at a very high level, a much higher level than we've experienced perhaps ever, certainly in terms of hospitalizations. And that's the real worry. It's not good enough just to turn the corner now. We have to get those numbers down and down very low. We do have capacity at the moment. I know it varies from hospital to hospital, but overall across the system, we've about 530 free beds, which is way more than we'd usually have free in a regular January,
yeah.
By the way. 30 free ICU beds. And we do have the capacity to flex up the private hospitals to use up to 60% of their capacity, and that work is now underway.
Is that 60% across all the private hospitals? Is there any one institution you'd be taking over in its entirety?
They're individual deals with the individual hospitals. Some of them are hospital groups, but they're individual agreements. Last time we did a blanket one and we just took over the hospitals entirely. This is different. So they're individual agreements, and it's between, we can access, depending on how much we need, 15, 30 or 60%, but we're now heading for the 60%.
And is that space there waiting to be used, or do you have to trigger that and then those private hospitals will create that space?
Yeah, we trigger it, and there are agreed criteria that are the trigger points.
So you're not paying for it yet, in other words?
No, we pay for what we use. So last time we paid a lot for capacity we didn't need, but I don't regret making that decision. It was the right one at the time.
Yeah.
This is slightly different. We only pay for the capacity that we use.
You talk about things we did before. Have you any plans to go back and do some work on the front line?
Well, I am available, and the Medical Council extended my registration and that of other non-practicing doctors. So I've said to the HSE that I'm available certainly to help with the vaccine clinics if they need me. I'd be more than willing to do it. I know I'm part of a group of 150 or so non-practicing retired GPs who are willing to do it. They don't need us yet because there aren't enough vaccines in the country yet, but we might get to that point in the next couple of weeks, and I'm certainly available. I know it's not the kind of frontline work in ICU or HDU which I'd like to be doing, but to be honest, I'm out of date and I'm not qualified for that, but I would be qualified for some areas and happy to help out
it
there.
It matters nonetheless. You could be given the Taoiseach as jab. You talk about vaccines then and the possibility when more come on stream that there will be, you know, some staff shortages, or there will be a need for people like yourself maybe to lend a helping hand. What are the latest figures today in terms of vaccine rollout? What can you tell us?
Yeah, so the HSE had their press conference today. So over 77,000 people have been vaccinated. And the HSE is now going to put up that data on the COVID hub within the next couple of days, so people will be able to see the data.
And then will
online.
That be updated then on a daily basis, like the rest of the figures?
Initially, it won't be daily, but it will be daily, but not right away. It'll go up and then be updated initially every few days, and then we'll move to daily reporting once the IT systems are up and running and tested.
And how long away
properly.
Do you think that might be?
Be February.
Just February.
Realistically, yeah.
Early February?
I don't want to put a date on it because I haven't been given a date, but like I say, the data will be there on the data hub in the next couple of days, and we'll move to daily reporting once we can.
Okay, so 77,000 have got the jab thus far. I think it's about 70,000 frontline workers and about 7,000, is that right, in private healthcare settings or in
the nursing homes,
homes is what I meant to say.
So the big shift this week will be to the nursing homes. So vaccinated over 35,000 people last week. Will be over 40,000 this week, mainly nursing home residents and staff, and then hitting about 50,000 the week after. So it is ramping up.
And what's your message to some hospital administrators in terms of doling out the vaccine? Because there have been reports of clerical staff or admin staff who are very far from the front line of a hospital CEO getting the vaccine. Meanwhile, I'm conscious with 2,500 odd GPs listening to the show, or certainly some of them listening to this show, many of them unsure yet as to when they're going to be vaccinated. Now, there has been a bit of clarity for them in the last 24 hours, but I know it's stuck in their craw to see non-frontline workers getting it.
Yeah, I know, and I sympathise with that. Bear in mind, there are some admin workers who do deal with patients all the time. Receptionists, for example, ward clerks.
Absolutely.
So the way the government policy and the direction is healthcare workers are divided into three groups. First priority are those who are dealing with patients and COVID patients in particular, emergency department, ICU, COVID wards. Second are healthcare workers who work in labs and in pathology. They mightn't be dealing with patients, but they are dealing with potentially infected blood and infected samples. And then the third is healthcare workers who aren't dealing with patients. So there have been some instances where that hasn't quite been followed. I think you do need to allow a certain bit of flexibility on the ground. You know, it can be difficult to go into a GP surgery, for example, and vaccinate three people and tell the one person in the office, sorry, you're going to have to wait for a few weeks. So I think we do need to allow for a bit of flexibility around that. But the government policy on it is clear that it's the healthcare workers who are dealing with COVID patients and patients generally who come first.
Have Moderna vaccines begun to be distributed yet? I know they arrived in the country earlier this week, a little earlier than expected. Are they still in storage?
I don't know for sure, but I think so. Yeah, I think they start being used next week. But
okay, so Moderna from next week, and then once you've got Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech in the mix, what is our vaccine target then from next week onwards? Let's set aside Oxford AstraZeneca for a moment.
Okay, from next week onwards, it's about 49,000, 50,000 per week, and it will stay at that at least until the AstraZeneca vaccine comes online. And that will give us significant more capacity. We'll be up to then 100 to 150,000 a week.
Why will it stay at 49,000? Is that because of the supply or just because of logistics or staffing ability to roll it out?
It's possible to flex it up and down a bit, but it'll stay in that ballpark because that's all that's available from Pfizer and from Moderna.
What about getting more vaccine? There's reports that in Germany they've secured a deal separately with Pfizer for an extra supply of vaccine. Have we explored that?
They did that before the European agreement. So since the European agreement came into place, individual countries aren't allowed to do that. So we have ordered through the European Union a lot of the Pfizer vaccine, but unfortunately the amount we're getting now, and it's the same for every other EU country, won't increase until the second quarter of the year, until April. Then we'll have a lot more of the Pfizer vaccine. So what we might find is, what was kind of the inevitable, is that at the start we would have a shortage of vaccines, and there's a risk that when March, April comes, we may have a shortage of people to give the vaccines, and that's what we need to make sure we work on now, so that we don't end up with a surplus of vaccines in March or April, and we are working on that now.
So 100,000 a week is what we're hoping to be able to administer, yeah, once you also have Oxford AstraZeneca.
Yeah, between 100 and 150,000 a week with the AstraZeneca. But, you know, that's heavily caveated. It hasn't been approved yet.
No.
We think it may be approved at the EMA meeting on the 29th of January, and then we have to get a delivery schedule. So I know what everybody wants. They want to know, they'd love to get something in the door in the post that tells them exactly what group they're in and when they're going to get it. If we did that now, we couldn't necessarily stand over it, because there are things that are not under our control and that we just don't know yet.
You spoke on this show relatively recently about getting through the first few phases of the vaccine rollout, or the first few groups. And once you get through kind of group three and into group four, that you, in reality, you relieve some of the pressure on the hospital system. And your cabinet colleague Eamon Ryan was making a similar point to Pat Kenny earlier today. Is that still your view? Because there is a counter argument made by the likes of Anthony Staines and Jerry Killeen and people who are involved in the zero COVID group, and they talk about, you know, there being a real danger in this country until, you know, 4.5 million plus people are vaccinated. And they talk about this being lockdown one of three lockdowns this year, inevitably, they say.
You made
different soundings that, you know, once you get to March, you can start to not throw caution to the wind, absolutely. But, you know, life could start to creep slowly back towards some normality, if that's a description.
Well, I don't think we're as far apart from them as that may sound. I suppose if you were to pursue a zero COVID policy in Ireland, you would need to close the border between north and south, which, and would have to be a real proper hard border, even though it might be dressed up as something else that wouldn't work otherwise. And you would need to be keeping the schools closed and all of that probably for the rest of the year. And we don't want to do that, obviously. But it's not that I anticipate that we're going to be opening up quickly. I don't. So vaccinating those most at-risk groups might reduce your, it'll reduce your cases by 20%, but might reduce your deaths and hospitalizations by 60 to 80%. But I don't think as a government and as a society, we particularly want to risk opening up again as quickly as we did in December. And we did that when we were only at about 300 cases a day. Mm. We're still at about 4,000 a day. And, you know, certainly would be my view and the government's view more broadly that any reopening that we do in the next 3 months certainly is going to be very gradual. As well as that, we would anticipate that, you know, social distancing and restrictions on gatherings will remain in place for many months yet, probably into the summer and autumn, unfortunately. So it's going to be a slow reopening. You know, the ability to halt that or reverse it if needs be.
You talk about when we reopened in December and the case numbers, we were at kind of floating between 200 and 300, you know, about the 250 mark, maybe average over a couple of days. In your mind, do we have to get lower than that before we begin to move out of level five?
I don't want to put a number on it yet, because, you know, I want to sort of at least hear and consider the advice from NPHET on that first, and we haven't got advice on that from them at this stage. One thing that does change the situation are these new variants of concern, and you can argue about to what extent the B.1.1.7, the British variant, has contributed to where we are now. What is not arguable is that more than half of the cases now are that new variant, and that new variant is more transmissible. So that 300 figure is actually more dangerous now than it would be back in December. So we have to bear that in mind.
So you don't want to give me a figure, but it sounds like you're saying in reality, we're going to have to get lower than we were in December.
Well, I think it's three things. I think the number of cases in the community has to be very low. I think we need the ICUs relieved. You know, you could have low cases, but still have 100 people in ICU, because you can spend a lot of time in ICU with COVID. So you'd want to see the ICU numbers, you know, falling towards 50 or even below 50. And the third thing is you want to have a critical mass of people vaccinated. And that's why I've said to people, I don't like to have to say this, but I am saying it to people as Minister for Business and the Minister for Employment, is to anticipate that most businesses that are currently closed will probably still be closed until the end of March.
Yeah, okay, until the end of March. Yeah, look, as you said,
but obviously the priority would be getting schools back, and then, you know, construction and maybe outdoor retail.
You mentioned the border between Northern Ireland, and let me ask you about travel. At the moment, if you want to travel into this country from anywhere in the world, am I right in saying this, you need a PCR test, 72 hours before you fly?
That's from a minute past midnight on Saturday.
From a minute past midnight on Saturday, that those are the rules. Those won't be the rules, though, for people flying into the north from anywhere in the UK, as I understand it. Mm. If you're flying into Northern Ireland from London, they consider that internal UK domestic travel, and there is no need for any PCR testing. That's a kind of a significant chink in our armour, isn't it?
Well, it's a big problem. And, you know, the requirement to have a negative PCR test before you enter the country or into the state, it's designed to do two things: to reduce travel, you know, to make sure only people who really need to travel do. And secondly, to reduce the risk of people with COVID coming in. PCR test isn't 100%, but it's pretty good.
Yeah.
But the problem is the big back door, and the big back door is Northern Ireland. We're engaging with the Northern Ireland Executive, requesting that they bring in the same or similar rules. You know, I do think Sinn Féin in particular has a role to play in this. They're part of the executive up there. They co-chair it. It's not good enough just to blame the other parties, you know, the DUP and the Alliance and whatever. When you're in government, you have a responsibility to convince your partners to do what's right. And then if you can't, you have to accept responsibility, shared responsibility for the decision.
That's a bit of a dig at Sinn Féin now. I mean, you may as well try and convince me that the sky is red and the grass is blue. Then you're going to convince the DUP to put up some sort of barrier between in what they consider internal UK travel.
You know,
it's easy for you to say, like, you know, you need to work with your partners. But I mean, you also have to be conscious of who they're working with.
Yeah, but I think as well, you also have to be conscious of collective responsibility. You know, this is the third coalition I've been in, you know, with Labour, with Independents, now with Fianna Fáil and the Greens. If I'm not able to convince my colleagues of something that I want to do, I can say that's the case, but I also have collective responsibility. It's not good enough just to, you know, stand on the plinth and blame your coalition partners. And at first, SDLP and Alliance, they don't do that. Sinn Féin are quite unique in trying to be in government and out of government at the same time. And I think the media should call them out a bit
more.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, but maybe that is the case with Sinn Féin, and maybe they speak out of both sides of their mouth. But it doesn't. That doesn't move us away from the fact that the problem party are the DUP.
I think there's a problem in that relationship, which is difficult, and you'll have heard...
The DUP are the problem in the relationship. Yeah, you can't say it maybe politically. Of course they're the problem in the relationship. When the entire world closed their borders to the United Kingdom, or to London and to southern England in particular, when that B117 strain, the English strain, was detected, they couldn't bring themselves to do it in the north. And not on public health grounds. Absolutely on ideological grounds. They were willing to risk the public health of the citizens in that state on ideological grounds. That's who you're trying to convince.
Well, you know, I think there may be two of them in it. And if you speak to Arlene Foster, what she'll say is that she believes things went really awry in Northern Ireland once the, you know, Bobby Storey funeral and the festivities or events around that occurred. And, you know, that's when the relationship really broke, I think, between the DUP and Sinn Féin. And that still hasn't been properly resolved.
Long before then.
They were working together a bit better. And, you know, in terms of risking public health, you know, you've accused the DUP of doing that. I think you could also accuse Sinn Féin of doing that too, given what happened around that event. And, you know, we still haven't seen accountability for it.
Let me ask you, before I let you go, I mentioned Richard Neal, the US congressman, who's going to be our guest in about 30 minutes' time. He was in the US Capitol last week. I'm sure, look, like everyone in the world, you would have been watching those scenes, probably kind of aghast at your television. Utterly incredible scenes. Is the United States a country, you know, like, is that in the world, is it a safer place in 5-6 days when Donald Trump's no longer president?
Well, it's a country I know and love, and I interned in Congress 20 years ago, and it was remarkable to watch those scenes on TV, you know, to see those people rampaging through the rotunda and through the offices. It was really shocking, actually, and it's a sad thing that any presidency should end in the way that it has ended. You know, I don't want to be engaging in party politics in America, but one thing I can say as somebody who knows and loves America, The world needs American leadership. It's not a perfect country, but by and large, it is a force for good in the world. And I hope that the new presidency will see the restoration of American leadership.
Tánaiste, Leo Varadkar, thanks a million for joining us here on The Hard Shoulder. Lots of people getting in touch on 53106. I promise I'll get to some of your texts after this quick break.